Good afternoon. It's with great pleasure that I welcome you to our second Fenwick and West lecture on intellectual property. As you can see from the low number, this is a new program for us. We are greatly, enormously grateful to the law firm of Fenwick and West and to one of its leading partners, William Fenwick, who is with us this afternoon, for endowing this lecture series. And Bill is a graduate, we're proud to claim, of Vanderbilt Law School. And through him and through this firm, we're able to initiate this lecture series in what we are sure will become a great tradition. Because it's a great opportunity for us. We're a great law school, as you know, and this is a great topic. For the foreseeable future, let's say the next 200 or 300 years, intellectual property is going to be a major issue. And of course, the whole story of the modern economy is the shift from a industrial to an information based economy. And as we move into the future and as we confront the obviously difficult economic landscape that we're now looking out on, it's clear that the world economy in general and the United States economy in particular is going to depend so heavily on this area. So it's a wonderful area for us to be for us to be involved in. Our speaker for this second Fenwick and West lecture is Charlene Morrow, who is a member of the firm of Fenwick and West. She is not a graduate of Vanderbilt, but of the University of California at Berkeley, where I spent a good deal of my career as well. It's also a good law school. And she is the chair of Fenwick & West's patent and litigation group, which has about 35 lawyers in it. She is a legal superstar and has, in fact, been ranked as one of Northern California's super lawyers by San Francisco Magazine. I'll just read you a quick list of some of her clients. It includes Apple, Hewlett-Packard, Macromedia, Macrovision Corporation, and the Regents of the University of California, who also have some things to do with intellectual property. And obviously San Francisco, like Nashville, is a as a economy and as a community is a major center for this enormously important area. So we're delighted to have Charlene Morrow with us. We're delighted to be able to establish and continue the tradition of this this lecture series. So thanks all for coming, Charlene.
Dean, thank you very much, and thank you to the faculty and the staff here who have, so far have been just tremendous. We also at Fenwick and West have a long debt of gratitude to Vanderbilt because they matriculated Bill Fenwick and sent him on his way to develop what's become an amazing Silicon Valley institution in terms of the firm, and also become a bit of a Silicon Valley institution himself. So thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you. Now, I know some of you here teach intellectual property, so to me, talking to you feels a little bit like I'm maybe bringing coals to Newcastle. But I thought I'd at least give you a little bit of a sense of how some of the developments in this area look when you're looking at it from the viewpoint of the information technology industry and what are some of the hot issues that have come up and maybe likely to come up in the Supreme Court decisions that are coming up. So let me just start with a brief synopsis on the Federal Circuit, and if you know this, you can send an email while I'm telling you this, and that is that the Federal Circuit was created in 1982. It was formerly a merger of the U.S. Court of Customs and Patent Appeals, and it was merged with the Appellate Division of the U.S. Court of Civil Claims. It was tasked in kind of a unique fashion with bringing uniformity to the area of patent law. And it was developed at a time which is kind of different than the time we find ourselves in now with regard to some industries, which is that there was kind of a societal or a political will to make patents stronger in order to protect the U.S. economy and U.S. industry. And so we are now, after a period of 20, 25 years, seeing what the fallout of that looks like with what we wrought in the 80s as a fix to a specific problem. The bench of the Federal Circuit, if you look at its composition from its formation, you look at its composition now, is really unique for a federal appellate bench. And as I go through some of the Supreme Court review of the Federal Circuit's decisions, you'll see how some of those unique aspects of the bench play out in what the Federal Circuit does and how the Supreme Court supervises what the Federal Circuit does. It includes patent attorneys from different disciplines. There is a chemist, somebody who has a great background in biology. There are attorneys with experience in various administrative and executive functions, attorneys who have spent their time on labor commissions, advising senators, and there are attorneys from private practice. The mix of the practitioners is really different because of the addition of the patent attorneys and because there are fewer people who spent their entire careers in district courts trying cases. The criticisms so far at this point, at least from the Silicon Valley perspective, and I deal mostly with information technology companies, the criticisms of the Federal Circuit so far are that maybe they've gone too far in making things too patent friendly, that they've created incentives for these IP licensing companies that are snapping up patents and asserting them against all the Valley companies, that they, in too many instances, maybe act as a court of first instance, deciding the technical facts themselves instead of deferring to a fact finder, and that they may be outcome determinative. Sometimes you'll look at their cases, they make a rule, and then each case after that has an exception to it. They don't seem to have a lot of rigidity to their case law. So those are the criticisms, and I'm not going to tell you whether I agree with all of them. I'm just trying to present kind of what the criticisms are of the Federal Circuit, what the Supreme Court has done, and what that tells us about what might happen in the future with regard to fixing some of what are perceived to be the issues with the court. So what is the current atmosphere? From sitting in the middle of Silicon Valley and working with a lot of information technology companies, there is substantial pressure from the information technology companies to reform the current method of enforcing patents. Let me just give you a practical example. We track new case patent filings against our clients. And I have a couple of firm clients that I track where I can look at the docket and find a new patent case filed against them in the Eastern District of Texas on average every 10 days for the last 18 months. And so what is happening is there's been the value of patents has indeed gone up as a result of the Federal Circuit decisions, but it's created this cottage industry of people who finance to buy patents and assert patents in litigation and try to get a return on that. And so that is obviously hitting hard the information technology companies who are, in a sense, aggregators of technology. I mean, if you look at just my computer, we've got things supplied by component suppliers all over the world, software written by developers here in the US and overseas, and every single one of those pieces of technology, every single component can bring with it multiple patent claims. And so the risk to the companies who are sitting in the United States and have combined and collaborated all this technology into my cute little laptop is that they will see all of those patent claims. So there's been an effort at patent reform pushed by those industries over the last year, last several years, and last year it really kind of faltered. And the reason it faltered is that there's a substantial disagreement between them and other factions who think that either the system isn't broken or it ought to be fixed a different way. So the patent reform came to a screeching halt with disagreement not only between what you would expect, patent holding companies and Silicon Valley technology companies, but also between information technology companies who view patents as a little bit of a plague. They want them as a defensive measure but don't want them asserted against them, and life sciences companies who view patents as the single way to protect their very long-term investment in the development of, for example, pharma products. And so those two industries were at direct opposition during the patent reform discussions, and that's largely why the patent reform efforts have pretty much fizzled out. There is one bill pending right now. It hasn't gone anywhere yet. But it's going to have the same problems because it's trying to address the same problems that brought the two industries to different positions. And it's also, reform has also been a problem because universities and research institutions have, in a sense, a strange alignment with patent holding companies because they are the other source of patented technology. And so there are issues in which, strangely enough, the universities and research institutions are lined up with the individual patent holders on issues. So what's happening now? I think there's a feeling that critics of the Federal Circuit are looking to the Supreme Court and hoping that maybe the Supreme Court will do something that'll fix the problem, that'll change the incentives in these cases just enough that it'll be less of a tax on industry. And so what I wanted to do was try to look at the Supreme Court authority to date and answer the question, is it? Is that going to be a possible fix, or is that going to be a strategy that could, in fact, backfire for the industry? So we've had 25 years so far that the Supreme Court has been reviewing Federal Circuit decisions. And if you look at the numbers, it's kind of an interesting mix of what they've done. They've issued 9 decisions on what I would call straight procedural issues, and I'll take you through a couple of them because they do matter. A couple decisions on the balance of power between the federal and the state legislatures, what conduct can one or the other reach. 5 decisions on what I would call run-of-the-mill statutory construction, important to a specific piece of the industry, but not necessarily everyone. And then 8 decisions over the course of some 25 years, 8 decisions that I would say are decisions from the Supreme Court addressing key areas of patent policy. And so they've given us guidance on where patent policy overall ought to go 8 times over the last 20 years. Now, I'm not being critical of them for that. When you see some of the procedural decisions, you'll understand why. But it is the reality that the Supreme Court has weighed in on patents not that often in the modern era. So what are the procedural decisions? Well, there have been, because of the mix of the bench, I think that the Federal Circuit as a whole may go astray on procedural issues more frequently than maybe some of the sister circuits who are a little maybe trial savvy, I think, and in their core. And so there are decisions like these, which I'm not going to talk about in detail, where the Supreme Court basically is taking the role of explaining claims and the difference between claims and counterclaims to the Federal Circuit. This set of cases is more interesting because this set of cases goes to the core of one of the criticisms of the Federal Circuit. And that criticism is that the Federal Circuit, because it has been tasked with fixing patent law, and because the members of the court often have are technically savvy themselves or have technically savvy clerks, they may be reviewing the decisions of juries or of inexperienced district court judges or district court judges without a technical background. They may step in and try to fix things technically more often than might be common in other areas of appellate law. And the Supreme Court has taken the Federal Circuit to task a few times, reminding it that it needs to pay attention to the standard of review. It's not a court of the first instance, and it really needs to look at the evidence and defer to the fact finder. So the first one was Dickinson, which was the Federal Circuit had come up with a reason why the Patent Office was a special body and the General Administrative Procedures rules shouldn't apply. And then based on that, had not given the decisions, the fact findings of the Patent Office, the deference that you usually give under the APA for only looking for whether there was substantial evidence to support a decision. And the Supreme Court took it up and said, no, you really do need to apply the APA to the decisions of the Patent Office. And so it changed the extent to which the Federal Circuit is given a mandate to take a close look at the actual fact finding that the Patent Office is doing as it's deciding what would be, for example, in this instance, references that you would combine to make a patent obvious. The next one is Dennison. I think that this was one of the early instances of this. What had happened was the Federal Circuit looked at a district court decision. It said obviousness is ultimately a question of law. It went through and reviewed the evidence in great detail, reached a conclusion that the district court had been wrong on obviousness, and remanded. It went up to the Supreme Court for review, and the Supreme Court issued a per curiam opinion and said, excuse me, but you didn't ever say that you were applying the standards of review that you ought to be applying, and so therefore we're going to send it back to you so you can analyze this again. Now, since Dennison, the Federal Circuit, if you, you know, write an appellate brief for the Federal Circuit, the rules for the Federal Circuit tell you that you have to state the issue presented, and then you have to include a section stating the standard of review for each question that you're presenting to the court. So the court is trying to get, you know, they are following this and trying to get a better grip on the standard of review. But I think it is interesting that at this point in the Federal Circuit's jurisprudence, they still haven't quite gotten onto that concept. There's a yet more recent example, and this is where this has gone now, is there's a whole body of case law when you're trying cases about did you object to the evidence, did you object to the jury instructions, did you object to the form of verdict, did you preserve issues for appeal, did you file your JMAL motions, and it's a way of regulating what issues are really ripe for the appellate court to review. And the Federal Circuit has not been terribly stringent in applying those standards, and that's something practitioners know, which gives them a little bit more leeway than maybe other practitioners have. But in Unitherm, the Supreme Court actually had to take this issue up because it's really the only body who's going to challenge what the Federal Circuit is doing, and saying that, no, you really have to apply the same JMAL rule, Rule 50B, that everybody else has to apply. And so you only should be reviewing what's happened if the proper objections were made at trial. So this is clearly going to be a continuing area as the Supreme Court, in a sense, supervises the Federal Circuit, what it seems to me is almost a Federal Circuit learning curve on the procedural aspects of the practice. Due process, this is just an example. It just basically held that the Federal Circuit was not supposed to ignore a due process challenge that was raised before it, even if it was rather inartfully pled. This one is important. And this is the last of the procedural decisions that I'll talk to you about. And that is the MedImmune case from last year. There are a lot of areas, because the Federal Circuit is supposed to fix patent law, and because there are a lot of unique issues that are a combination of procedural and patent law issues, the Federal Circuit has a tendency to create its own procedural rules because it impacts the determination of an issue of patent law. And so one of the areas where it had been doing that was in the question of when was there a declaratory relief action available to you. And let me kind of step back on that. The Declaratory Judgment Act is one of the main tools for a potential patent defendant to avoid the Eastern District of Texas or the Middle District of Florida and try their patent claim or their patent challenge someplace else. And so what the Federal Circuit had done was crafted its own special rule about declaratory judgment jurisdiction. And what it said was very friendly to patent holders. It said that you can go out and contact companies and talk to them about the patent. You can offer them a license. You can talk to them about why you think they might need a license. You can do all of that, and it's, you know, no foul. You're not going to get hailed into court for that. You're only going to get hailed into court if you make some threat of legal action that gives the person you've contacted a reasonable apprehension that they're going to be sued. Once you have the reasonable apprehension, then you guys can all run to the courthouse and decide who gets there first. And so that was a test that was created by the Federal Circuit to address the specific pre-litigation licensing negotiations that occur, but is something that the Supreme Court took up last year and reversed the Federal Circuit on, saying that, no, the Federal Circuit should have been applying the more general standards that are applicable to other kinds of declaratory judgment actions, and not applying the special heightened threat of litigation standard. And so what the Supreme Court has done in this instance is reversed a patent-friendly decision, but it reversed a patent-friendly decision not because it thought the patent policy was wrong. It reversed a patent-friendly decision because it was the Federal Circuit's special rule just didn't fit within the framework of other declaratory judgment jurisdiction. I mean, it cited its own prior case from the 1940s. It cited what the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit do in contract cases. It was really telling the Federal Circuit that this was a procedural issue on which it should not have been making new rules for patent cases, but should have been looking for analogous instances in the rest of the law. So this is an important one in terms of changing the dynamic for patent defendants, but I don't think it was a particularly policy-driven decision by the Supreme Court. Now, statutory construction, I'm not going to go through these in much detail. If you replant plants, you care about one of the decisions. If you design medical devices or pharmaceuticals, you care deeply about these two decisions, but they weren't particularly patent policy-based decisions, so I won't talk about them in much detail. And then the Federal Circuit, or the Supreme Court's also issued two decisions, kind of statutory construction decisions on damages. The first one is just a standard statutory construction decision. The second one, Microsoft versus AT&T, is interesting. I mean, it's obviously very interesting to anyone who provides a software golden master from the U.S. and ships it overseas, because what the Federal Circuit had held was, if I take the master for Windows and I ship it overseas and reduplicate it, that the patent damages are going to include every reduplicated copy that I supplied from the U.S. And so what the Supreme Court did was step in and say, no, we don't think that's right. It was basically a decision on statutory construction. It wasn't a decision that we don't think that the scope of the Patent Act is that broad. But there is a clear discussion by the Supreme Court of a consideration the Federal Circuit didn't give much weight to, which is the general notion that in absence of a clear congressional intent to reach extraterritorial conduct, that the courts just don't go there. And that's consistent with Supreme Court precedent in antitrust cases and in copyright cases and other instances, but was an important consideration in the statutory construction in terms of policy that the Federal Circuit didn't weigh because it was focused primarily on patent policy. So there are two balance of power decisions, nicely balanced, as it were. One says that the U.S. Congress erred in imposing liability for patent infringement on state institutions and research institutions, saying that it was an unconstitutional abrogation of state sovereign immunity because there was no evidence that there was some huge issue in our society of universities and research institutions rampantly infringing intellectual property. That's unlikely to come back again soon. And then there was a decision, and I'm including this one here even though it's an appeal from the Florida Supreme Court because it touches on a key issue on the scope of the patent laws. This is the decision where the Supreme Court said, well, we've legislated and decided what can be patented, and when those patent rights expire, and how long you can wait before you patent something. So the federal patent laws fully occupy that area. And so state statutes that tried to extend that by, for example, making it illegal to copy a bolt call in Florida or illegal to copy a car windshield mirror in California, that were preventing the copying of unpatented articles were things that were preempted by patent law. So aside from the interest of California liking cars and Florida liking boats, I think it was an interesting decision because it took on a Federal Circuit opinion that it wasn't an appeal from, but finding no preemption of a California statute and being rather terse in its assessment of the Federal Circuit's reading of its prior authority. So now we get to the policy decisions. And essentially there are eight policy decisions from the Supreme Court in the modern era. And so the question is, where is the Supreme Court going? Is it going in a direction that is going to make it easier to get a patent, harder to get a patent? Is it going in a direction that's going to make it harder for patent holding companies to do their business or easier? What tea leaves can we read from the recent Supreme Court authority? I think there are two cases that really talk about what the nature of the patent grant is and what is it that you get when you disclose an invention to the patent office and then get your patent. What does that really mean? What do the rights of exclusion mean? There are, I think, three decisions that talk about what does it mean to infringe a patent? What are the outer limits of that? And then there are three decisions that talk about what can be patented or should be patented. And these, I think, are the most important in terms of, trying to read tea leaves for the future for any of the industries that are impacted by the Supreme Court's decisions. So the first one is eBay. And let me give you a little background. The status quo prior to eBay was that if you went to a trial in district court and you lost, there would be an injunction entered against you against further infringement almost as a matter of course. And the way that the courts got there was that the Federal Circuit took the approach that the Ninth Circuit and other circuits, I think Second Circuit, have taken with copyright, which is they said, well, okay, intellectual property is an intangible right. Intellectual property, the only right you get out of intellectual property is some kind of right to exclude. And so if you permit someone to continue infringing after there's been a liability determination against them, you have basically vitiated that right. I mean, there isn't anything left after you say that you can't stop someone from practicing what you have the right to exclude. Well, that seemed to make sense to a number of circuits in various contexts in patent and copyright. And so the rule developed that there was a presumption of irreparable harm. And so you could get a permanent injunction by coming in and saying, I have a patent. It's now been adjudicated valid. It's been adjudicated as infringed. And without an injunction, the infringer is going to continue its current conduct. So you should enter the injunction now and stop. And so you would have the hammer blow at the end of the case of an injunction that you might get stayed for a short period of time, sometimes get a stay for appeal, but not always. You'd have the hammer blow of an injunction stopping you from practicing whatever the conduct was that was at issue. And that was a huge bargaining tool for plaintiffs, because if you lost in a case, of course you thought something went wrong. And you wanted to appeal to the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit reverses claim construction a lot, reverses other issues a lot. And this injunction rule was the big hammer that would keep you from taking your case all the way through, was the risk of, in the meantime, getting an injunction, not getting a stay, and being stuck without your product. The Supreme Court took it up, and what it said was, it went back to basics, read the patent statute, and it says an injunction may issue. That's what Congress wrote, an injunction may issue. That means it's not mandatory. And they really undercut the notion that intellectual property is this special thing that ought to be treated differently because of its nature. And instead what they said is, in each case, you go through and you do the analysis you always do before you grant an injunction after trial, which is you look to see, is there irreparable harm, etc. The impact of this decision is still rippling through the district courts as various courts try to figure out what to do as the Federal Circuit takes various appeals. But it's been a sea change in the way these cases are tried, because if you think about it, if you go to trial and you win and your patent's valid and it's infringed, usually the jury gives you some money. That means that the jury has valued what the patent is worth over a specific time period from when they filed suit or when the patent issued through verdict. So therefore, a lot of district courts have said, well, that means you don't have any irreparable harm. We know what the value of the patent is for a given time frame. We can increase that if you're willfully infringing afterwards, but we know what the value is, so there's no irreparable harm. So the approach of a number of district courts has been to deny the injunction, but require a running royalty at the level that is indicative of what the jury awarded. For example, turning a dollar value verdict into a per unit royalty and assessing it on the parts going forward as an alternative to an injunction. And what is going to happen to that is something that's bubbling in the Federal Circuit now, and something that is, I think, likely to be the source of further decisions as everybody figures out what are the equitable powers of the court. But given that the reviewing body is the Supreme Court, might make a really good idea to read about the equitable powers of the court in other areas of the law. So then this year's decision is Quanta Computer versus LG Electronics. And this one I put in the category of also determining really what the nature is of the patent grant. Is the patent grant something that is inviolable? Is the grant of the patent something that is trumps other public policy considerations in certain respects or not? So the background on this is that there has been for a long time Supreme Court jurisprudence in the copyright area and in the patent area with the first use doctrine. And so the idea is, you know, I sell my computer to someone. As soon as I sell it to you, you can do whatever you want with it.
I don't have the right to then say, you can only resell it to the people I want you to, you can't resell it at the at anything other than the price I want. Those kinds of restrictions have all been held to be violations of the first sale doctrine. If you think about it, old school, you've got a textbook. It started in the kind of publishing cases where some of the first cases were, if you buy a book, you can take the book home and mark in it, you can sell it, you can do whatever you want with it. Once the rights holder has gotten some value for his rights, he isn't able to therefore continue enforcing them downstream. So why is this in front of the Supreme Court? What happened is the Supreme Court authority says when there's an unconditional sale of the article that is patented, then the first sale doctrine applies. So LG Electronics said, okay, unconditional sale. I'm going to make all my sales conditional. So LG Electronics does a cross-license with Intel. Intel makes microprocessors, as we all know. And they said, I'm licensing you to sell the microprocessor. I'm not licensing you to combine the microprocessor with memory or anything else that might make it useful. And I'm going to then go and enforce the patent against Quanta. What Quanta does is take the microprocessors, sticks them on a board with some memory and some lines, and that's the next subassembly in the process of getting from Intel's chips to your computer. And then LG also went out and said, okay, if I'm going to go after Quanta, who puts together the subsystems, or the other Taiwanese defendants were ASUS Tech and other companies that were combining components into subsystems, I think I'll also go out and give notice letters on my patents to Dell and HP, because after all, my patent goes to a little thing that's combined and put into these computers, and I ought to be able to get a royalty at each stage along the way. And their theory was that because they had conditioned the initial license to Intel, that everything after that, that the first sale didn't occur until downstream. And so therefore, they were exempt from the first sale doctrine. And the Federal Circuit said, looks like a condition to me. It's in a contract. Fine. It's a conditioned sale. That's fine. And was going to let the lawsuit go ahead. And then we have this appeal to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court looks at its prior authority and says, we have some prior authority that addresses this that the Federal Circuit just, I think they say grievously, misread. And that what we've said before is that once you put a substantial piece of the invention out into the market, whether it's completed or not, if it's really the key elements to the invention, you put that out in the market, you get paid for that, that's it. The first sale doctrine applies, nothing else. And they had had a prior case, Univis, which was lens grinding. So somebody supplied, the patent was on these ground lenses that had certain configurations. Somebody supplied the lens blank. The only thing that had to be done downstream was polishing. And the Supreme Court had held several years ago that supplying the lens blanks meant no rights after that downstream. And so the Federal Circuit looked at this and said, everybody has agreed in this case that the microprocessors don't have any other substantial non-infringing uses if LG's theory is correct. We're going to take the claim, by the way, was to bus management. And it was basically caching some information instead of sending it out and then manipulating the data in a particular way. And obviously what was the core to that was that the microprocessor was issuing all of the instructions for the communication to take place. And so in the LG case, the microprocessor was the critical thing. You could tack memory on, you had to tack memory on in order for it to work, but that was really the essential function. And there wasn't another essential function for that device. And so the first sale doctrine applied. So this says that the Federal Circuit's decision, which basically said you can contract around the first sale doctrine, that these contract rights or that the patent grant is really in a sense more important than the first sale doctrine, so you can contract around it, that the Federal Circuit made the wrong policy decision there, that the first sale doctrine and the protection that it gives to people, consumers who want to use something that they've purchased, is the more important policy. So I think this is one of the decisions that is important to us because it tells the Federal Circuit to pay attention to some of the older Supreme Court doctrines and not assume that the patent concerns are going to trump the other considerations that the Supreme Court has previously voiced. So, trying to make sure I'm on time here. I don't want to make anybody late. There are three cases. So we know from the last couple of years of Supreme Court jurisprudence that the patent grant is not inviolable, that it ought to be treated the same way as a contract when it comes to equitable relief or other types of relief in the court. And we know that the patent grant is still subject to the first sale doctrine, no matter what the Federal Circuit thought. Now, what has the Supreme Court done on infringement? There's two pieces to an infringement claim. There's the piece that says, you literally do everything that's in my patent. And there's a piece that says, you almost do everything that's in my patent, and the one thing that you changed is an equivalent to what's in my patent, so I still get to call you an infringer. And so there's literal infringement and infringement under the doctrine of equivalence, and the Supreme Court has taken up both. And that group of decisions has been kind of interesting to practitioners because it's been a bit of a seesaw for us in terms of trying to figure out what the Supreme Court really wants to do to, in a sense, control the chaos of patent litigation or not control the chaos of patent litigation. So the first decision was when the Supreme Court took up, and this is actually a Federal Circuit affirmance. I think this will be the only one that I talk about today. But the Supreme Court took up the question of what is the role of a judge in these patent cases when you're trying to determine whether patent claims have been infringed. What had happened before this was that one person's expert would come in and say, I've read the patent, it contains these features, your product's the same, it infringes. And somebody else's expert would come in and say, I've read the patent, I think he has the scope of the patent wrong, it doesn't actually cover these features, our product's different, you don't infringe. And so the jury would be faced with trying to decide what the scope of the patent grant from the U.S. government meant, as well as the factual issues about, well, is this the same or not? I don't know. And so they would hear evidence on all of it. It would get put in a hopper, they'd make their decision, and then that would be reviewed by the Federal Circuit. So what Markman did at the Federal Circuit in Markman and got right was they looked at the question of, well, what is the role of the court in this situation? And this is a situation where they actually did look to contract law. The Supreme Court didn't, but the Federal Circuit did. And they said, well, this is kind of like a contract with the government. And in contracts, if you're in litigation in a contract and you have a dispute about what the contract means, the judge can rule on that as a matter of law. And so shouldn't we take the approach that if you're litigating a patent and you want to know what the claim is, and the claim is your contract with the government about what your rights are, you gave up a disclosure, you got some rights, the claim's like the contract, let's construe the claims as a matter of law. And that was upheld by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court held that that was not a violation of the Seventh Amendment. Federal Circuit gave a kind of cursory treatment to the Seventh Amendment issue. I don't think it was really very well presented to the Federal Circuit in the briefs. And the Supreme Court did a very thorough review of, you know, is this going to be a Seventh Amendment violation? Are we taking something away from the jury that was, you know, tried to the jury, and decided that, no, this was okay. And so now we have kind of the modern system for patent infringement, for direct infringement. And so the way cases go now is the judge holds a claim construction hearing. He says, what do you think the claims mean? What do you think the claims mean? He decides. Then issues a jury instruction on claim construction. And then the jury will have that instruction. Sometimes they're holding it. Sometimes it's in a chart. Sometimes it's just read to them. But in theory, they have it in their minds when they are applying the evidence to the claim. And of course, the lawyers who are arguing it and opening and closing are using the claim construction to explain why they think it is or is not within the scope of the claim. And then there are summary adjudication on the literal scope of claims where there's no dispute about what the product does, and the only dispute is whether it's really within the scope of the claims, then some of the courts will wade in and grant summary adjudication, either of infringement or non-infringement in that situation. So this decision is one that dramatically changed kind of the chaotic system of presenting patent claims to the jury, because it gave the jury a much tighter set of guidelines to work with as it was trying to figure out what was in the patent and inside the patent scope and outside the patent scope. So some practitioners, and I will confess, including me, thought that this meant that the Supreme Court really was concerned about the chaos of patent trials and was going to do something with the other piece of patent trials, which is, what about the doctrine of equivalence? And so shortly after Markman, there was an appeal. Shortly after Markman, there was an appeal in the Warner-Jenkinson case. And this was the most hotly watched case of the last decade. I would say that eBay was the most hotly watched case of this decade. But this was the most hotly watched case of the last decade from a practitioner perspective, because what it did was it went to the Supreme Court and said, please reconsider your existing doctrine of equivalence doctrine, because it has completely gotten out of hand. There had been a spike in the amount of litigation. The result of the prior decision, which made claim construction more clear for literal infringement, is that every plaintiff asserted infringement under the doctrine of equivalence as an alternative. And so instead of having a chaotic trial on this, you had a chaotic trial on whether what's in the scope of a claim is equivalent to what's found in the product or not. And so what some of us were hoping is that the Supreme Court would say that there were some limits on when you could actually go after infringement under the doctrine of equivalence and substantially restrict the doctrine so that it was easier for someone to tell whether they were touching someone else's patent rights or not. I mean, it's one thing to read the claim and try to make a balanced determination about what is or is not within the scope of the claim. It's a yet harder feat to read the claim and know that there is an uncertain scope outside and not be sure what to do with it. Well, the Supreme Court said no. The Supreme Court said, weren't you listening when we issued the Graver-Tank decision in the 1960s? And basically reaffirmed its existing authority on the application of the doctrine of equivalence in the majority of all cases. So the current trial mix is that the Supreme Court has made it harder to prove literal infringement and left doctrine of equivalence largely alone, and that's where most of the litigation is at the district court level on infringement. And it's also the point that is one of the points that is one of the hardest to get review on, because you have competing expert opinions on something. The jury has picked one, and if the Federal Circuit is listening, it is supposed to be looking just to see whether the jury made an error. So now what did happen? There were these two cases, and they did go after the scope of the doctrine of equivalence in one situation, and that is during patent prosecution. You go through a process of a short discussion with the patent office. It's a short discussion, but it takes place over many years. Where you submit a patent application, you get an office action back where the patent office cites prior art against you. You either argue that the art is not applicable or you amend your claims. The patent office will also come back and tell you that there's not support for certain things in your application, that certain aspects of your claims, that certain aspects of your claims are just fatally indefinite, et cetera. It will issue a series of rejections. You respond to those. It is, in a sense, a discussion about the scope of the rights that you're ultimately going to get from the patent office. And what the Federal Circuit had done was started a line of authority, and it was a little confused at the time Warner-Jenkins went up, but it had started a line of authority saying, basically, in the doctrine of equivalence area, if you give away claim scope during the process of this negotiation, you can't get it back. And then the discussion that was going on amongst the panels of the Federal Circuit was how broadly that rule should be applied. Is it if you amend the claim for any reason, then you can't get doctrine of equivalence on the amended element? Or is it if you amend the claim to get around specific prior art and then something else comes along that does exactly what that prior art did, then you don't get that? And so there were a number of inconsistent panel decisions on that. The Supreme Court and Warner-Jenkinson basically accepted the basic doctrine, but sent it back to the Federal Circuit to do a little further work on the doctrine before the Supreme Court took it up again. And then several years later, in 2002, it kind of interesting, the Federal Circuit went back and forth on this for a while, and then adopted en banc a very harsh rule that said, anytime you amend, for any reason, we don't care what it is, the element in the claim that you amend, you may have five elements and you amend two of them, those elements, you don't get any equivalence on those elements. That's it. We're not going to do anything more than that. Then that went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court adopted a rule that was less harsh than the Federal Circuit, but still said we're going to assume that any amendments mean you should give up claim scope. So this is something that has somewhat restricted the doctrine of equivalence, but not to the extent that would dramatically change the trial landscape that we're seeing today. So there are three validity decisions, and then I want to talk briefly about what's going to come up next. The three validity decisions, the first one, I confess I didn't pay a lot of attention to this decision when it came out in 2001, because I wasn't paying a lot of attention to plants in 2001. But now there is a big push to try to get the Federal Circuit to take up what is patentable subject matter. We've had an explosion of patents relating to business methods being issued by the Patent Office. And there's a case, Bilski, that everybody hopes is going to be the case where the Federal Circuit says something about whether these are statutory subject matter or not. Can you get a patent on a particular way of settling trades at the end of the day when you've been doing stock trading? Can you get a patent on a way of settling out your inventory? Can you get a patent on a way to avoid a tax assessment? And these are things that the patents have been issued. There's a lot of concern in industry about them. And the Federal Circuit has been asked and should be ruling soon on whether these are statutory subject matter. Given that, I think that this decision, which kind of crept under the radar, is something we all might want to pay brief attention to. In 2001, the Supreme Court took up, apologies,
get a glass of water. Okay, hideous frog in the throat.
The Federal Circuit took up what is patentable subject matter most recently. The case that you read when you're doing patent law, you usually read the one I can't pronounce, which is Chakrabarty, which involved a man-made organism. But this is the most recent discussion of this issue. It came up in the context of whether you could patent a hybrid plant. And there had been a Plant Protection Act from 1930 that had protected only non-hybrid plants. And the question was whether by adopting that statute, Congress meant to exclude hybrid plants from protection because they didn't expressly mention them. And the Supreme Court said, well, actually, in 1930, you couldn't characterize a hybrid plant well enough in order to be able to meet the disclosure and deposit requirements for getting a patent on the plant. And so the fact that technology has advanced such in the intervening years that you can now come up with a hybrid plant, identify it as useful, and characterize it well enough to get a patent on it means that you can get a patent on it. And they recited the same analysis that they did in the microorganism case, saying that anything that is a human-made invention is patentable. So I would suggest that the folks who are holding out hope that Bilski is going to dramatically change the world on patentable subject matter, it may for a short time frame, but I think that that's one of the issues that would be something of interest to the Supreme Court, as would the other patentable subject matter areas, like can you patent a research tool, and is likely to be something that is taken up. And I think any success based on this case and the prior case is likely to be very short-lived on that. What the court said in this case is, if you can describe it well enough to get a patent, then go ahead and get a patent on it. And I think in the business methods area, there's likely to be a similar conclusion that if you can convince someone that it's not obvious, then go ahead and get a patent on it because it is a human-made invention. So what about prior art and what about KSR? KSR is the other Supreme Court decision, and I think the Supreme Court decision that's going to most dramatically impact how practitioners try patent cases over the next few years. And they're important decisions on validity from a practitioner's standpoint. But in terms of being decisions about where is the Supreme Court on patent policy, it's actually kind of interesting. So FAF was a case on the on-sale bar. And what that says is that if you've had the invention out in the public and you've put it on sale and it's been out there for more than a year before you filed your patent application, tough, you can't get a patent on it. Similarly, if someone else has done the same thing, you can't get your patent. So it's an on-sale bar. What the Federal Circuit had done was put really detailed requirements around what being on sale could constitute. And so what they said was, well, we don't think you're really putting your invention on sale unless your invention is reduced to practice. You're far enough along that you think that your invention is likely to work. And so what that meant was that somebody could experiment for years, could offer, you know, betas, as it were, to the world, and not trigger the on-sale bar as long as the invention wasn't yet reduced to practice. So it was a very patent-friendly rule, and it was also a rule that was difficult to deal with as practitioners, because then the question was, when did you, you know, in a subjective state of mind, when did you think your invention was going to work? And very seldom do people actually write that down somewhere. So what the Supreme Court did was step back and say, wait a minute, you've gotten away from the statutory analysis on this, and held that you need not, as a matter of course, restrict the invention to things that are reduced to practice. So that was a relatively defendant-friendly decision, but it was made on kind of a statutory ground. KSR is the most important.
Don't worry about sneaking out. I know you have more important things to do.
KSR was the most important case for us in terms of how we're going to go forward, because what it did was look at what the Federal Circuit had done on a different statutory bar and say, well, the Federal Circuit is again engrafting a rule set on and making it harder to invalidate a patent. So what the Federal Circuit had been done had been doing in KSR was saying, okay, Section 103 says a patent can be invalidated for being obvious. And we know obviousness usually means combining two pieces of art and saying some elements are in one, some elements are the other. We'll combine them, the invention's obvious. The KSR case related to a sensor and a brake pedal being combined together into a brake pedal with a sensor. And what the Federal Circuit had said was, when you take those two pieces of art and you line them up and decide whether something is obvious, there has to be a teaching to combine the two, either in the art, which is what some panels of the Federal Circuit said, or in the knowledge of one of ordinary skill in the art. So the sensor and the brake pedal, you would have to show that either in those articles or someplace else, somebody said, wouldn't it be great to have a brake pedal with a sensor? And so it was a very strict test for whether something is obvious, and it basically required finding every single one of the elements and a suggestion to put them together someplace in the art. And what the Supreme Court did in KSR from an analytical perspective is not that surprising, but it has a big ripple effect in litigation and in patent prosecution. What they did from an analytical perspective is say, wait a minute, we never adopted the teaching to combine test. The Federal Circuit came up with that. And if you read Graham versus John Deere, which was our last helpful case on this topic from the 1950s, we didn't have a teaching to combine test in there. And so we're not going to adopt one now either. So they said that you don't have to look for an express teaching to combine. And they also said that the other narrowing thing that the Federal Circuit had done, which was say that you have to look at problems in the same area. Like there's a lovely series of cases about whether you would look at a technique that morticians use and use it in a meat yard, and I won't go any further than that. But they would say you would have to look at a particular field only and not look outside that field for the solution to the problem, and that you would have to look for the solution to exactly the same problem in the prior art. It can't be somebody was doing something for a different reason. So those were all the limits that the Federal Circuit had put on obviousness, and those limits were all stripped out by the Supreme Court in KSR. So now we have the 1960s Graham versus John Deere regime, and I think it would be fair to say none of us know quite what to do with it, because one of the things that's been unclear all the way along is that the Supreme Court has said whether something is obvious is a matter of law, but there may be secondary factual considerations in that assessment. So then the question is, okay, how does the judge or the Federal Circuit deal with that combination of things? You ask a fact finder to find the facts, but then you make the ultimate determination as an issue of law. And some judges have read KSR. One judge I will not mention by name in particular, have read KSR as being a license for the district court judge to decide obviousness by herself on summary judgment, by him or herself, on summary judgment and without a fact finder hearing any of the evidence relating to obviousness. So obviously there's going to be some time, sorry, that was a bad pun. There will be a shaking out period as district courts and lawyers try to figure out how to deal with this, and as it goes up to the federal circuit and we try to figure out how the federal circuit is supposed to review this mixed question. And they've talked about it before, but this case, I think, applies a little more pressure to how they do that analysis. So now I'll finally answer the question that I asked before, which is the Supreme Court really likely to be something that fixes the problems that the information technology industry sees? And I would say no. The decisions of the Supreme Court that have addressed kind of issues of patent policy, basic issues of patent policy and the scope of patent rights, have been by and large to date decisions that say you should have read my decision in 1930, you should have read my decision in 1950, you should have read my decision in 1960 in Graham versus John Deere, you should have read the 1854 cases on XYZ. It's basically been a go back to school lesson for the Federal Circuit. And in none of these cases has the Supreme Court really stepped out and set new patent policy. We see KSR as something that is dramatically different. And it is dramatically different in the way that the Patent Office is going to look at patents and in the way that the district courts are going to look at patents. But it is dramatically different in the sense that we're going back some 50 years to looking at the regime as it existed then under Graham and before the Federal Circuit started engrafting additional requirements onto obviousness. So I would suggest that those who think that the Supreme Court is going to step in and somehow corral from the beginning some of the issues with the way that patents are being enforced and the tax that it's taking on our community, I think that that's something that is a little bit of wishful thinking given what the Supreme Court has done so far. Now, obviously things could change. We saw that there were dramatic changes in patent policy over the scope of 20 years covered by these slides, but I think it's something that's unlikely to be changed at the Supreme Court level and more likely to be change that various industries are going to have to agree on. So, now what is going to come up? Probably some more claim construction. The Supreme Court hasn't looked at damages yet, and there are some interesting issues there. They're still kind of a mess at the Federal Circuit on this, and no clear Federal Circuit decision that has been the damages case to take up. Like there was that recent Lucent versus Microsoft $1.2 billion verdict in San Diego, and the damages award was thrown out. And the plaintiff was trying to get it reinstituted, but there was an issue with their ownership of the patent, so the Federal Circuit never reached the question about, you know, how is the damages analysis supposed to be done when the patented invention is one tiny component in this whole system. So those things still need to get sorted out at the Federal Circuit level and a rule set adopted before I think they'll go up to the Supreme Court. The Federal Circuit also hasn't gone for the modern Supreme Court standards on when you give punitive damages, so that's likely to be something of interest, although it's going to come up in fewer patent cases given what the Federal Circuit has done there. What is patentable subject matter? I'm not sure certain industries want that to come up before the Supreme Court given what they said in GEM. Standards for invalidating, the Supreme Court has really addressed the biggies, so I think that's unlikely to be an area of much interest. And then I think procedural issues will continue to be of interest, obviously looking at the decisions that the Federal Circuit has issued and looking at the kind of procedural things that fall out of some of their other cases, like, you know, how do you address the KSR deference to the fact finder and how do you deal with specific jurisdictional rules. So with that, there are so far no Supreme Court cases on the spring docket unless something happened today. And I'll stop and take any questions. Okay. The guy sitting in the front of the room, I don't know.
I got in here so early, but they're late or something. So, the Supreme Court in denying, in this spring term, denied cert for In re Newington, mm-hmm. which, and a lot of people thought that decision was very wrong because it seems to fly in the face of Jim and Chakrabarty. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea why they decided Jim so recently and Newington seems to be contrary to that, why did they deny certiorari?
I mean, there's some, and there was also a research tool case last term that they denied cert on too. And it was just, I think there was a sense of some practitioners that they're probably, frankly, tired of patent issues and they ought to deal with, I don't know, capital punishment or something. So. You had a question.
Yeah, I was struck. I had lunch last week with a federal judge and he had said that as a district judge, you liked his patent cases and really questioned whether there was a need for a separate court for patents. And I wondered, sort of based on your experience in the trenches, whether you have a view, and particularly some of your comments, I mean, it seemed like you suggested that the court being off on its own is a bit out of touch with procedural issues and the like. And I wonder, on balance, how you see whether it's a good idea to have a court at all?
Well, I think it's a, I think that's a tough decision. And I think the way to resolve it is what's been happening with the most recent appointments at the court, which is there have been recent appointments to the court of people who have spent some time in the trenches. And I think that adding to the mix of skills that are already at the court will tend to make the court a little savvier on some of those issues, and maybe a little less subject to this Supreme Court review on some of the procedural things. So I think that that's something that could get adjusted over time with the composition of the court as opposed to being adjusted over time with the abolition of the court. Although I do think there's some areas where I frankly think that the discussion, ongoing discussion between the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit on a lot of copyright issues is fascinating. And I kind of wish there was a similar discussion going on about patent law. But I guess that's your job. So, yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned the Eastern District of Texas several times in the presentation, and that brought up, and you also mentioned how reform at the legislative level was mostly stalled, but there's been a lot of talk about changing the venue rules to prevent everything from piling into the Eastern District or a couple of districts. Do you foresee that going forward in the future, or is that pretty much stalled too?
So the venue reform is stalled as well. It was a part of the same package. And I think a lot of us were somewhat skeptical of the proposed venue reform as actually being effective. And there were a couple of rounds of it. The first round basically said you have to have somebody, you know, resident in Texas. And then folks thought, oh, well, wait a minute, a patent holding company incorporated in Marshall is resident in Texas, so that's enough. And then they grafted on a requirement that they would have to do substantial research and development in the area of their location. And that's where they kind of ran up against the interests of a lot of other companies. Because, you know, a university doesn't necessarily want to have to, you know, be limited in that fashion, and neither do other entities. So that's where I think the whole thing foundered. Because until that last proposal, it was something you could get around quite easily, and people were getting around quite easily by reincorporating at a particular address in Marshall, Texas. So. Not that, love Marshall, lovely. So, are other questions or?
Okay, well, okay. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity.